Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler. I'm also a writer and producer on Criminal Minds, and we're soon to start season 12. We're really excited about that. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and director and co-founder of Paladin, the National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also the author of Dash, Risk Assessment Model.
And
Lisa Zambetti, I am the casting director for Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, where I work with my dear friend Jim Clementi.
And my brother Tim Clementi.
Oh, that's right. I don't think people know about your brother. We haven't talked about him yet.
Well, we will, okay. I guess.
All in good time.
Yes, he's also a former FBI, and he's a writer on Criminal Minds Beyond Borders.
Which has also just gone to being picked up.
That's yes. Right. That's
season
right.
Two.
Season two.
That's great. Criminal Minds, ship sails on. We are at the point where we would like to discuss some of the details about what went on the night that Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were brutally murdered on Bundy. And, of course, nobody's been convicted at this point of the criminal murder that occurred that night, although OJ has been held civilly responsible for the deaths of Nicole and Ron. Nobody has actually been criminally convicted for it. And we think, Laura and I have been discussing this, and we think that there can be further investigation and prosecution and conviction on this case.
We do, and certainly if there's the appetite for it. And just to say that Jim and I actually looked at the crime scene assessment independently and separately, and then we discussed it thereafter. And, of course, we've been going through and analysing the trial transcripts as well as looking at the show, in particular, The People versus O.J. Simpson, as well as lots of other documents that are out there too, and the civil trial. So we've put a lot of time and effort and energy into analysing what's gone on, so the what, the where, the when, the why, the how, to get to the whom.
Right. And the how, in this case, definitely affects the who.
It does.
And not only when we're talking about sort of the domestic violence situation that went on between OJ and Nicole for years, OJ being the perpetrator, Nicole being the victim for all those years, but also additional circumstances. I've told people before in prior podcasts that at the time that the O.J. Simpson case occurred and when the trial was going on, I was actually working with Dr. Henry Lee. He's a world-renowned criminalist, which what that means is he's a forensic scientist in many different fields that have to do with crime and criminal investigations and prosecutions. So DNA, chemistry, fiber evidence, blood spatter interpretation, crime scene reconstruction. He's a world-renowned expert in all those things. And just an amazing guy and a great friend. And we were actually working on the Vince Foster equivocal death investigation. And what that means, equivocal death, means when you have a case where somebody has died and it is not clear whether they died by homicide, suicide, accident, natural, or undetermined causes. And because of that, there has been become an area of investigation, a specialty, one that I developed over the course of my career as well, in investigating equivocal deaths. And you do a number of things, including not only the physical surroundings and the physical evidence, but also a psychological autopsy of the victim. And what that does is it reflects back on the offender, who they were exposed to and who might have had access to them to kill them. So those are very, very important types of investigation, and they can basically lead to startling conclusions sometimes. So Dr. Lee worked with me on this equivocal death investigation. And at some point, we might actually talk about that on Real Crime Profile, the Vince Foster equivocal death investigation.
Yeah, just in case people who aren't aware of who that was. So he was the deputy White House counsel during the first few months of President Bill Clinton's administration. And that's kind of all I want to talk
about.
Yeah, she was. That.
And he ended up dead in a park, in a national park, a couple of miles away from Washington, D.C., just outside of Washington, D.C. There's a lot of, if you look it up, there's a lot of conspiracy theories and so forth about that. And I'm sure that as the elections draw near with another Clinton aiming for the White House, that people will probably drag up some of this information. But that's for another day and another time. So let's get into this. So first of all, who is Dr. Lee? I think we've kind of covered who he is, but he has a forensic science institute at the University of New Haven, where he continues to teach forensic sciences as well as consult on actual criminal cases. So he's in the state of Connecticut, but he has actually traveled the world and works on cases, very difficult cases, all over the world. I remember him telling me at one point his schedule, his calendar was so booked up that the head of another country had actually sealed off part of the palace for that country for 18 months until Dr. Lee's schedule had gotten cleared so that he could go there and investigate the crime that occurred there, the homicide that occurred there. So they removed the body, but everything else remained there for 18 months so that Dr. Lee could come. And he's done some incredibly high-profile cases, including the O.J. Simpson trial. And one of the things that happened in this case, in the O.J. Simpson criminal case, was that Dr. Lee had offered his services to the LAPD and the prosecutor's office in L.A., and he said that he believes that he can add to their information that they had, and that he believed there was more than one offender in this case. They told him they already had their man. His name was Orenthal James Simpson, and they were not interested in hearing anything more. Shortly after that, the defense team, the dream team, scheme team, whatever you want to call them, contacted the governor of Connecticut and said, well, if the prosecution isn't using Henry Lee, we would like to use him. And then he came out and went to evaluate the evidence in the trial. When he did come out to look at the forensic evidence in the trial, he said he was treated very badly by the LAPD or the LAPD lab. They would put him in a lab with no electricity and with broken microscopes and so forth. And he was so fed up that he said, I'm leaving. I'm coming back with my own lab. And he bought his own lab with him and basically said, I'm going to find every single mistake you made and I'm going to put it in your face. And that is one of the reasons, one of the contributing reasons why the trial was lost, because Dr. Lee is a formidable force. He's an amazingly engaging personality, so that when he takes the stand and he explains things, he can do it in very simple terms, very practical terms, and juries love him.
My quick question, how soon after the killings did he contact LAPD and say that he could come out and help?
You know, I don't know exactly how, but I know it was certainly before the trial. I'm not sure whether it was before or after the Bronco chase, but as we saw in the dramatic representation of the case, when the dream team basically formed itself by trying to get the major speakers, the major lawyers in the country who were speaking out against O.J. to be silent, they hired him on the team. And so F. Lee Bailey and Dershowitz were hired onto the team because they had been very vocal on the news immediately, saying, oh my God, this case looks overwhelming, and now he's being chased by, you know, on a slow speed chase in the Bronco. This looks really bad for O.J. After they got hired onto the team, they couldn't make any public statements. So it was one of the control things, how they controlled the media.
But the other thing to say, just about expert witnesses like Dr. Henry Lee and others, is that they are nonpartisan and they're there just to present findings of fact. And yes, they may be asked their opinion, but I think the stats for Dr. Henry Lee was that he did do about 95% of his work for the prosecution and about 5% of the work for the defence. So this is an interesting
twist
in terms of him collecting the evidence and, you know, putting it objectively before the court as a man of science to say what the crime scene
and you revealed. You just said it. He's a man of science, and he's very, very strict on that. He will only say things if there's scientific proof of it. And for example, if you see a drop of blood on the floor, he'll say that's a blood-like substance until it has been scientifically tested and proven to be actually blood. But speaking of drops of blood, he actually was called by the defense to examine OJ in his home, and he found drops of blood in OJ's home. He found the cuts on OJ's hands. He documented them, and he turned them over to the prosecution. So it wasn't like he was just trying to get OJ off. He had a very definite idea of what happened based on the evidence. And I remember him going through the crime scene photos with me. I was an FBI agent at the time, and we were working on another major crime at the time. And going through those, and I remember him telling me, explaining to me why he believed that there were more than one person involved in this double homicide. One of the indicators of this was shoe prints around the crime scene. Another indicator of this was the fact that there were two people that were controlled that did not leave that small enclosure. Another indicator of this was Ron Goldman, who was a third-degree black belt, was not able to defend himself sufficiently. I mean, he was murdered.
No, he did fight back.
He fought, yes.
There's indications that it was between, you know, it may even be between 10 and 15 minutes that he's fighting back. So, you know, we know from his defense wounds. So he would be a very hard guy to take down.
Take down alone, right? And the last part of it is that Dr. Lee matched up the holes in Ron's jeans to the knife wounds in his legs. And he believes that both legs were up and kicking when he was being stabbed. And his theory was that that could only happen if somebody was holding him from behind and somebody else was stabbing him. Now, I've also promoted an alternate theory. If somebody was holding him from behind with one arm, where they grabbed around one arm to the other arm and locked their hand on that arm and held their arms close to their chest, to the sides of their chest, and then reached around with his other hand, with a knife in that hand, I think you could get that same result. If you were strong enough, if you were big enough. And remember, Ron was 6'2", I believe?
Yeah, he's definitely over 6 foot.
And a very athletic and trained martial arts expert. So he would definitely have been in a position to fight back if he were not incapacitated immediately. And clearly the fact that he had defense wounds.
He had bruises on his knuckles, I mean, all over his hands, on his legs. So he clearly gave a pretty good, you know, he put up a pretty good fight from all indications from the post-mortem and what was said about his physical condition.
Yeah. When you start looking at what we know is a well-documented history of domestic violence perpetrated by OJ against Nicole, where the police were called at least 9 times to her residence, that generally he got a talking to or a slap on the wrist, that he did not ever have to answer for his crimes, and that, like many women who are the victims of domestic violence, who have children with the offenders, they still want to maintain some kind of relationship, but they want to be able to have their own life. And what we know on that day, that she ended up dying that night, Nicole had told her sister that she was ready to start her new life, that she was finally going to just get rid of OJ and that whole mess and being abused by him and go on with his life. She wanted to take a vacation and celebrate her new life.
Yeah, I mean, the context of this is really important. And having reviewed hundreds of domestic violence murders, and looking at the crime scene assessment, this is, for me, classically a domestic violence homicide. And Dr. Werner Spitz, for me, is the other very important person giving expert witness testimony, who basically said that it was a murder committed in rage and anger. And the way that it was carried out in terms of, I mean, he called it overkill, but certainly she was almost decapitated and was left to bleed out. And when we understand the whole context, you know, with domestic violence murders, those that I've reviewed on behalf of the Home Office, it's very, very rare to get a domestic homicide that just comes out of the blue, for one. There's normally a whole pattern contextualized of abuse. And one of the things I'm seeing much more drawn into sharp relief now when I'm looking at risk factors and the antecedents is finality and rejection. And I actually believe that it wasn't just one rejection that OJ suffered within the course of the preceding days and weeks. It was actually a double rejection. That Nicole, in fact, had rejected him, yes, that she had made a decision that she wanted to get on with her life. And I think there was so much back and forth, and she was trying to ensure that the children had a father. She was balancing lots of things, and financially, she was balancing things whilst he was threatening her that he was going to, you know, have highfalutin attorneys to ensure she wouldn't see the children, all the things that we know that abusers do, and coercively control her. And the second point is just around Paula Barbieri, who was the girlfriend of OJ Simpson at the time, and having now had a chance to go back and listen and look at some of the things she's written. They certainly went to a black tie do that night, and we don't know exactly what went on that evening, but the next day she decides to finish with him, and it's the day of the murders, and she actually leaves a 30-minute voicemail on his phone breaking up with him. Now, you know, that contextualization, whatever it is that's being said, and I haven't got to the bottom of that yet, but if you finish with someone and, you know, it's a functional transaction, you know, we're through, we're done, that's it, and hang up. But actually, she had far more to say than that. And we know that some of it was to do with the fact that she believed that OJ was so obsessed with Nicole. And I'm using that word because it's her word. And we know about obsession and fixation and stalking. Right. We know that he did stalk her. And we also know that he was cheating on Paula. And, you know, she couldn't deal with all of that, and knowing that he would never truly be hers. But she wrote a book called The Other Woman, and in that book, as we know, with a lot of victims of domestic violence and coercive control, 52% of them don't self-identify as victims. But the little extracts that I have read of it are all about abuse and how he treated her, and, you know, constantly putting her down and questioning her about infidelities and cheating. All the things that he did to Nicole, he was doing to Paula. And of course, past behaviour is the best predictor of future behaviour. So the context around motive, you know, we always want to try and understand why something has happened. OJ Simpson has suffered a double rejection. And this is a man who is entitled, who believes that he owns his women, the ownership, the possession, the entitlement, and the way that he views them absolutely comes into play here. And the way the murders are carried out absolutely fits with that. And Dr. Werner Spitz's testimony is absolutely spot on in terms of what he says of the behaviours at the crime scene and what Jim and I have looked at in terms of the crime scene assessment. This is up close and personal. This is revenge. This is somebody getting close, wet work with a knife in the victim's ear, talking to her whilst this is happening. And this is absolutely about wiping out her. But unfortunately, Ron is the person who's there trying to save her. And I do believe he, from his injuries, he put up quite a fight, and he certainly, it wasn't anticipated that he would be there, so the attack would have taken longer than possibly what we first thought, to be able to rain blows certainly on both of them, but incapacitate and kill.
Yeah, I mean, the injury on the top of Nicole's skull looks like it could have been administered by the butt of a hunting knife. And that would have been hard enough to render her unconscious, at least for a period of time. And with some of the injuries on Ron, it also appears that he may have been temporarily incapacitated. But certainly at some point he must have regained consciousness and was fighting back. Mm-hmm. Fighting back valiantly. And as Laura just mentioned, he was most likely trying to protect Nicole. That was the kind of person he was. But the fact is that there, with all the evidence that there was a ongoing pattern and escalating pattern of domestic violence, the fact that Nicole actually a few days before she died called a shelter because she was desperately afraid for her life, the fact that she had predicted on other occasions, he's going to kill me and he's going to get away with it, all those are indicators that O.J. Simpson did in fact plan and participate in the murder of Nicole, and Ron happened to be there. He happened to be there at that particular time. There's no way they could have planned that he would be there, but he, unfortunately, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
And we know certainly that they're at a dance show beforehand, OJ and Nicole, and there were eyewitnesses who were there who said that OJ was just fixated, staring dead at Nicole the whole way through. So this kind of, you know, bubbling volcano, mm-hmm. watching her seething, being angry, you know, also fits with the sequence of events. And that's what I always ask people about. Well, what was the build-up? What was the sequence of events? And then, of course, there is some time and distance, you know, in terms of hours. Nicole is meant to be going to a restaurant with all the family and is actually booked into Jason, O.J. Simpson's son's restaurant, Jackson's in Beverly Hills. But the party of 11 don't turn up. They actually go to Ron Goldman's restaurant. Now, whether there was a telephone call to say that they weren't going to be appearing at Jason's restaurant, the 11 of them, or not, I'm unsure. But certainly her not turning up, no doubt, angered Jason.
Well, if he made the reservations, I mean, 11 people showing up for dinner and drinks and so forth, you're talking about, you know, a couple thousand dollars in Beverly Hills. This is not a small deal. And apparently the fact that they didn't show up meant that they actually, that restaurant closed early, sent their staff home.
We should clarify, Jason, he was a chef there, right?
He was a sous chef.
Okay.
And a sous chef would be sort of the assistant chef, like the second in command.
Yeah, and they do all the prep and they do, yeah.
Right.
And I, having worked in restaurants, I don't know if you guys have, but when you have a big party like that coming in, you know, you're excited, your family's coming, you're kind of showing off who's right. there. You know, it's a big deal
when
your family comes to the restaurant.
When they don't show up, that could be quite a problem.
Yeah.
That could create
humiliation,
sure.
Anger.
And anger. And since we're talking about Jason, by the way, why don't we talk about his history? What's going on with Jason before this happens?
First of all, he's the son from the first marriage.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's now, age 24 at this time.
So was OJ cheating on his first wife with Nicole? That's the question. Is Nicole the one who was, quote, responsible for OJ leaving Jason's mother? Even if she wasn't seeing OJ while he was still married, she is the one that OJ shacked up with and started having kids with and married afterwards, after his mother. So that could be one check in the box of a reason for him to be angry at Nicole, right?
It could be, or, you know, potentially, for me, they're closer in age, for a start, Nicole and Jason, than Nicole to OJ. And there are, you know, indications that they were going out, they were hanging out together, they were going to clubs and parties, and they'd actually got quite close. So I'm just, you know, putting it out there that perhaps there was a connection, or he thought, a connection between them, and, you know, started to become quite attached to her. And if he saw her in a romantic way, i.e., you know, a younger guy having a crush on a well-put-together older female because she was strong and ballsy and cool and, you know, good-looking, that could have manifested. And actually, you know, him enjoying hanging out with her and spending time with her. So he actually saw it as more than kind of a stepmother, but her rejecting him was more potentially on an intimate basis. And, you know, he does have a history with other women. He was seeing other women, and he has a history of violence and abuse and using knives.
He has. And we'll definitely break that down. But, you know, one of the issues was that he was actually taking Depakote. He was taking it for bouts of rage and for seizures. Only he stopped taking it a couple of months before this homicide. So that's something that we know, Laura, right? We've seen before that it takes weeks for a drug, when it's in your system, to actually get to a therapeutic level. And also the inverse is true. When you stop taking it, it kind of is in your system for a while afterwards. And sometimes if you cut off a drug like that immediately, like you're supposed to wean yourself off of it rather than just stopping it. And if you do cut it off, it can cause really extreme psychological results. And so it could actually exacerbate a situation. He was taking it because he had bouts of rage. That's important to note. He also was drinking heavily. He was drinking alcohol in large amounts, and between that and taking Depakote or getting off Depakote could be a recipe for disaster.
And he was on probation at the time for having attacked one of his, I believe it was a former employee.
Yeah, his boss.
Or employer with a knife.
Yes, so, with the knife at a restaurant, yes.
And two of his ex-partners, Jennifer Green and Dee Dee, he had attacked equally and violently assaulted them. And one, I think it was Dee Dee, he actually cut her hair off with the knife and they feared that he would kill them. So some of the antecedents here are incredibly relevant to what goes on that night.
Did he have an alibi that night? What was going on?
Well, it looked like he did have an alibi because he was in the restaurant. But there was a private investigator called Bill Deer from Dallas who looked into that in a bit more detail. And what he found out was that the restaurant closed early. Now, whether it was Lisa because the big party didn't come in, but they found out that he had closed the kitchen early and his girlfriend had picked him up and taken him and his knives that he was holding in a holdall back to his apartment. But Bill Deer worked out there was a window of time to allow him to leave that apartment and actually make his way to Bundy. That was doable, although the police never pursued anything further than, yes, he was alibied, and as far as they were concerned, that was the end of it.
Hmm. I have to say that it is not unusual for chefs to take home their knives, just to put that out there. They're very, very valuable knives, and people, you know, they're very
personal.
They
always carry
yeah, they have these, like, special things that
they roll them up in, yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah, I used to own a restaurant, too, and the chefs would do that. Yeah,
oh,
sure.
Sorry, I don't
No, it's okay.
We gotta talk about that.
Yeah. Oh, it was the most stressful thing I've ever done in my life.
I bet.
Oh,
sorry.
So that's a contextual thing that, that chefs, you know, do tend to do that, but it becomes more relevant when we're talking about this particular scenario.
Correct.
And that particular
Correct.
Night and that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's the context that I'm trying to build. And, you know, the fact that the timings do work out
yes.
is highly, you know, doable
yes.
to get from where his apartment was to Bundy.
It's certainly circumstantial evidence that he would have been available. And the fact is that one of the reasons why they thought he was alibied out was that his time card said he was at the restaurant till later. But as it turns out, he handwrote the time that he checked out instead of clocking out, which would have given the accurate time of when he clocked out. He wrote a time that was later than he actually left. And they've already developed evidence that the time clock was functioning, that he did not have to write it in because the time clock was down or something like that. So it seems like he was creating an alibi then, which is an indication of premeditation.
So why write it himself? And the other person who sort of corroborated that was the girlfriend, and this investigator Bill Deer went and actually spoke to her, and she was very clear of the timings that she had picked him up and driven him back to the apartment, and she didn't stay, she just dropped him off and then left.
Right. So that's one more checkbox on the side of very interesting suspect. Another thing is that he is trained in hand-to-hand combat from
he was military.
Yes, he was. And I guess Jason had fallen behind on payments on a storage unit, and so he snapped it up. Deer snapped it up, and he was able to find not only a sheath which looked like it had the initials JS carved into it, but also a combat knife, basically, that could have been used in these murders. And certainly, it's also consistent. The butt of that knife is also consistent with the kind of weapon that could be used to create the injury that was found on the top of Nicole's head.
He'd also spent, I think he'd checked himself into a mental health facility previously as well for these, you know, bouts of anger and rage that he felt. So clearly he was trying to do something about his behaviour.
Right.
But I think the two ex-girlfriends' accounts are very interesting about how his behaviour to them manifested. And again, a history of abuse and domestic violence, while he's looking at his father, no doubt, to see how he behaves and absorbing quite a lot of those things, you know, those messages, those things that tell us, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And here he is just mirror imaging back those things to his partners. And they were both frightened of him. So that also tells us a lot. And I think when we think about going back to the crime scene, and it's really Dr. Werner Spitz's testimony, because he talked about firstly, a left-handed killer, the way that they were grabbed from behind, but also that Nicole had blood under her fingernails, and that blood was tested, and it wasn't O.J. Simpson's blood. And the way that Werner Spitz described it was he felt that, you know, somebody putting their arm around her neck, she had then put her hands up, trying to grab that arm or hand away
kind of
from her neck,
away,
clawing
right?
it with her fingernails. And Werner Spitz actually talks about the cuts on OJ's, I think it's his left hand, his fingers were fingernail marks rather than knife or glass marks. But interestingly, when that blood group was tested under her nails, it came back as blood group B, which is an OJ's blood grouping.
Mm-hmm. But we wonder, could it be Jason's?
Exactly. So it tells us that maybe, you know, in terms of how OJ gets those marks, well, they're not fingernail marks from Nicole, could be from somebody else, or could be, you know, injuries from a knife or something else. Because actually, OJ never gave a truthful account of how he got those injuries on his hands.
Of course not. Because that would have been yes,
indirect, you know, moving away from it, and gave lots of different accounts. So who knows which one was the credible one.
Right. So at the same time as you have OJ developing a long history of rage targeting Nicole, you have the sort of culmination of that, because Nicole said she was going on with her life without him, his girlfriend, partially because of how obsessed he was with Nicole, is breaking up with him on the very same day. He's staring daggers at Nicole during their kids' dance recital. And so it seems to be coming to a head this night. At that same time, you have Jason, who may have had sort of designs on Nicole or may have had reason to hate Nicole, but either one of them could have led him to have one of these bouts of rage. The difficulty is, so how did they premeditate this
exactly.
if they worked together?
Yeah.
And certainly I think OJ would have had to have an overall plan, and he may not have planned on the timing of it exactly, because he may have thought that, you know, he had a certain amount of time to be there, to be back at the house, so because he set up a limo driver who was going to take him to the airport to get him out of town. So he would know that he had to, you know, sort of this window of opportunity. He knew how long it would take to get back to Rockingham from Bundy and so on and so forth. But I don't think he expected there to be two people there. However, he may have had a conversation with Jason where Jason said, you know, she stood me up at the restaurant, and that just, they kind of riled each other up. I mean, they're both prone to this bouts of rage thing. And did they at
and
that
poor
point?
Poor impulse control.
Yeah.
I think that's the other point, because when Jim talks about premeditation, we're not talking about somebody who's ruminating on murder for a long period of time.
Oh, no.
This is in the day
right.
of the double rejection, and this is how, you know, behavior happens. It's particularly with people with poor impulse control.
Right. Just going there with murder in his mind is premeditation. I mean,
But he didn't know how it was all going to come to pass or the timing. And, you know, if we believe that empty Swiss Army knife box was left in OJ's bathroom, you know, it certainly shows signs that there wasn't a whole amount of you know, criminal sophistication and forethought
right.
in terms of how to carry this out.
Right. And, you know, just the same way he left his socks, dark socks with dark blood stains on them, on his floor. I mean, you know, it's not a criminally sophisticated or forensically sophisticated thing to do. But when you're in the actually heat of battle, something that he's not done before, which is he's never, that we know of, murdered anybody before. But that sometimes what that does is it takes you, and you basically fall into patterns of behavior. So, you know, if he's used to taking off his socks and throwing them on the floor, that's what he did. Maybe he normally let the maid clean that stuff up. Who knows? But
this is about acting in the moment. You know, the person he wants to go and see and have this out with is Nicole. So, you know, it sounds like he's moving, you know, at speed across that time period. Because as you said, Jim C., he's got this limo, he's got this flight book. That's his kind of alibi of where he's going to be. And, you know, we don't know what exchanges, where the phone records were pulled for O.J. Simpson and Jason, for example, to know what communications were going down across that time.
Yeah.
Whether it was as organized as that, which I doubt very much it was.
If O.J. did this with somebody else, it had to be somebody that he could completely trust, that he knew would be helpful in that situation.
And control,
yeah, there you go. And so you have two men who are prone to rage-filled outbursts, poor impulse control, and they have a common target.
And interestingly, I mean, we'll get to the part, you know, Nicole certainly thought that she did have a stalker, and she said to a couple of people that she thought that it might have been OJ or Jason.
Oh, she said that to somebody about Jason?
Yeah, she did say that it could be Jason. You know, so it tells us that there was clearly some kind of close relationship or something going on there, attachment-wise, that was more intimate than sort of stepmother, stepson.
At least, maybe in his mind.
Had he become infatuated with her, you know, and it was a slight, you know, all of those things do make sense. It's not a huge leap of faith when we put it in, place it in its context.
Okay.
What?
I hear. You're not buying it. I know. I am, and I am not. I mean, I've read about this. I know, you know, I've read a lot about actually Bill Deere and his theories and such. So if your sources be. Other than him, I'm more likely to...
But remember, 20 years before Bill Deere had anything to do with this case, I had conversations with Dr. Henry Lee while he was involved in this investigation.
Sure.
None of this is based on Bill Deere. He has added some facts that seem to corroborate what our theory is or what our individual theories were. I mean, Laura had been studying the case separately from me before I talked to her about what Dr. Lee had said to me years ago. And like she said, we both came up with this
separately. I actually came back from Malaysia. I remember the conversation and had the conversation with Jim C. about, you know, what about if there were two of them? You know, and if we take, and then Jim shared with me Dr. Henry Lee's hypothesis around it. And the two shoe prints, you know, yes, we know the crime scene was contaminated, but Dr. Henry Lee saying that there were two that he believes a 10 and a half and a size 12. And we know about the Bruno Magli, so that puts OJ there. I don't know about Jason's shoe size, but Werner Spitz's is the first time I'd listened or watched and read his testimony, and him saying about the under the fingernails of Nicole, and it's not OJ's blood. That tells us somebody else is there too.
Yeah, no, I can clearly see where you're both heading with two assailants there. Absolutely. I'm just trying to take my mind through how it can be both premeditated and yet spur of the moment. Jason is so mad because she doesn't come to his restaurant. Like, he wasn't planning to kill her before that, but...
It could be 15 minutes can be premeditated. Yeah. An hour can be premeditated. A year can be premeditated. It just has to be the forming of the thought, the intent, before you get into the circumstances in which you actually carry out the murder. If you are doing it, for example, if he comes home from work one day, he walks in the door, and there's somebody in bed with his wife, and he pulls out a gun and shoots him. That's clearly not premeditated unless he knew that the guy was in there and he faked it, right? But that's all you need for premeditated. So what this would mean is whatever time dinner was supposed to be, and of course she had finished dinner and gotten home, and Ron had gotten to her place from that same restaurant, a lot of time had elapsed from the time that Jason found out they're not showing up. At least 2 hours, at the very least. In that 2 hours... He and OJ could have had a number of conversations or had gotten together and met and made a decision.
We're going to make her pay, and I'm going to go put my wetsuit on, but he's not... I mean...
Well, how do you know he didn't have a wetsuit, too? What do you mean?
Think that Jason could have had one, too?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
I mean, any of those things are possible. When you think about, you know, murder, in inverted commas, you know, people think about the way they see it on shows. Mm. And that's not how it happens.
It's usually messy.
it's messy. There are things that don't make sense a lot of the time because it's, you know, things that are in the heat of the moment that people are rolling with, where they're not thinking through everything in a rational way and conscious decision making. And, you know, certainly when we're thinking about a first degree murder charge, you have to have the premeditation that it's intentional. And a lot of for the prosecutors, that's what they have to look at all the time. So, you know, what conversations took place, we don't know. But we know when we think of motive that Jason, there's certainly questions to be asked of him because of alibi, lack of, and because of motive. And we know with OJ Simpson, well, we can place him at the scene. So that's not in doubt. He was actually there. The second person is the question mark.
Right, and who...
We believe the forensic evidence.
Right, and who else? I mean, one of the things is the cap that was found there. That there's a bunch of pictures of Jason with a similar cap on, and it also had animal hair. And it was consistent with OJ's hair, but Jason's hair would have been consistent with OJ's hair too, probably. And Jason had a dog. There's a picture of him with the dog, and a cap that's exactly like the one that was found. But who? We have to ask ourselves behaviorally, who could OJ trust in that kind of a situation? Do we think it was Cowling? Do we think that he would have gone to, you know, gotten into the Bronco with AC to go on this slow speed chase where he was going to kill himself? Would he have actually gone with the guy that he killed Nicole and Ron with? It doesn't sound like it to me. I don't think that would have happened. I don't think that AC would have been driving that car if he had helped OJ actually commit the murder. But
maybe one goes there and then the other one shows up. Maybe they're both making a beeline for the place because they want to have it out with Nicole. You know,
yeah,
the chances of that are far more
right,
likely.
So,
they both want to have it out and somehow.
Right. So OJ goes there planning this. Jason shows up like, what the fuck? Or they're on the phone. Or he's like, mm-hmm. I'm on my way there right now.
Yeah.
You know?
And he goes and starts having a fight with her. Gets out of control. And maybe he kills her. And the other guys that know.
He plans to. Yes, you're right. I think he plans to have a fight with her. But he gets there. And who's there? Ron Goldman. Who the fuck is this young guy? Who's this? Oh, you break up with me today? You tell me you don't want me in your life today? And now you're already with this other guy? You know? Boom, that's it. Just
explosive
bouts of
rage.
Right.
And that's the thing that everyone talks about with OJ.
Yeah.
That bout, that explosive that can just happen. And we heard it on the 911, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we could hear him in the background. That if you're the person that stood there terrified, and this person's come charging through your door and your children are asleep. I mean, he sounded absolutely terrifying to Nicole.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we know that he can just explode like that. His poor behavioral controls and impulsive behavior.
And so then Jason is there, and instead of trying to stop his dad, he's just
helping him
helping
out.
Helping him.
He gets complicit in it. Yeah.
Yeah,
he has to, you know, start to help him out. I mean, if we take it away from the crime scene, just some of Jason's behaviors post-offense, I think, are also quite interesting in that, and we saw one of the things on, well, two of the things actually on the People versus O.J. Simpson, which is when O.J. comes back from the Bronco, you know, in the Bronco, the very first person who greets him at Rockingham is son Jason.
Right.
And there's an exchange. Now, people are making up those exchanges
because
who knows what was said
what
at the time.
What he said, right. Like,
but, you know, I thought that was a very interesting scene. And then you have the puppy scene at the end where Jason gives him the puppy.
I just want to make sure you always have a friend.
Yeah. And for me, that's again, whatever was said, because that puppy thing did happen, but whatever was said, only they know.
Mm-hmm.
But what an odd scene. And why they included it in there, I think, is because it's saying something about a bond that we don't know about. You know, it's not just a father-son bond. I think there's something more. And then, I couldn't say his name, Lisa, Don
Ohlmeyer,
mm-hmm. who's the president of NBC, who backed OJ right from, you know, the get-go, the whole way through the trial. He then gave Jason a job. So post-trial, Jason stops working at Jackson's in Beverly Hills and he actually starts to work as his private chef in his house. Now, again, this kind of, you know, it could just be a completely innocent gesture,
mm-hmm.
but is it about keeping somebody under the radar, keeping them contained and controlled within a, you know, a situation? And, you know, within him chefing in a home versus chefing in a restaurant, you know, it may not have been even a spoken conversation between OJ and his very powerful friend, but I think there are some interesting questions at the very least to be asked of Jason.
And just the history of Jason having pulled a knife on his boss and pulled a knife on his girlfriend.
Mm.
I mean, this is somebody who, that's behavior that is consistent with what happened to Nicole and Ron. And so it's just the kind of thing where we have to be very honest about what is the most likely suspect. So what will we do from here? I mean, the fact is that there is no statute of limitations on murder.
Well, Jason, actually, Jim, there's one last thing just to say. And
okay.
I know we mentioned it briefly before, but one of the big question marks for me was the Robert Kardashian, the holdall, the Louis Vuitton holdall that he took out of Rockingham that was never examined or understood what was in that particular holdall.
She's talking about the, we call her garment bag.
Or a duffel bag or something.
And nobody knows what's in there. They had a dramatic scene in the dramatic series about OJ where Kardashian thinks maybe the weapon might be in there and he opens it up and of course it's not there. But if it were there, he certainly isn't.
Well, a weapon or a wetsuit or items of clothing.
Right, but here's the thing. I mean, Kardashian, we all know that after OJ got off, he ended his relationship with OJ. We all know that he wanted to end that relationship earlier, but he said the appearance, if one of his lawyers left during the trial, it would look like he thought he was guilty. But he did think he was guilty. That's why he wanted to leave. So,
and on his deathbed, more importantly, at the hospital, he would not accept any phone calls from O.J. Simpson, which speaks volumes.
It does. So there very well could have been something in that bag that he unwittingly carried out, but then later found out was, oh, my God, this is actually evidence of the crime. So there are a bunch of things that happened that make us believe that if there was another person involved, and there is indications that there was, that the most probable person would have been Jason. And it's somebody that had a close relationship with OJ, that could be controlled by OJ, and continued to have a close relationship with OJ afterwards. So I'd say he's prime suspect number one. The fact is that there should be probably an independent counsel investigation into this. I think it would be difficult for the LAPD or the LA District Attorney's Office to conduct that investigation just because of the history of that trial, of the OJ trial. But I think it should happen because there is no statute of limitations on murder. Jason, if he's guilty, can be tried and convicted today.
And the point of fact that this is a murder that has not been solved, in inverted commas.
Right.
So it has to be looked at in the sense that if there's new evidence or if there's a question,
it's still an open case.
It's still an open case. So why aren't people actively looking for the answers if not OJ? Or if we play it the other way, let's say, yeah, we can put OJ at the scene. And we know that, you know, he was having sex with Paula Barbieri the night before Nicole's funeral as well. So this is somebody who we go back to being remorseless, etc. But so whichever way we slice it with OJ Simpson, he's not going to go on trial for this murder again. But there could well have been this second person, as we've said, Jason.
But he'd be tried as an accomplice, though?
There you go.
Oh!
Okay, exactly. He can be tried as either an accessory before or after the fact. That was not included in the trial that he was acquitted in. These are totally separate charges. If he helps somebody else kill Nicole and Ron, then he could actually be tried for that. Now, here's the thing. Is the statute of limitations still open on that? We're not sure. There's probably some argument that would keep it open longer if they just determined that somebody else was a suspect in this case and they arrested that person. Then it may be that statute of limitations in terms of helping that person. In other words, if they just got evidence recently about another person being involved in the crime, let's say hypothetically somebody named Jason Simpson, and then they find out that somebody else helped that person and this is a new investigation, then it may very well be prosecutable. And, you know, there might maybe some theory upon which you could have obstruction of justice or some continuing conspiracy to conceal, which he could be prosecuted for, even if he couldn't be prosecuted for the pre or post helping commit this crime. Mm-hmm. So I think it's something that's real. It's viable. It's an investigative avenue that should be pursued because on the books, this case is an unsolved double homicide, a very serious crime. And it would be amazing to see that brought forward and an investigation actually completed. And hopefully, given the fact that we had planned this episode months ago,
right,
before things had sort of come to a critical mass as a result of the show on the TV, when the program was coming out, we had already had the plans of going from making a murderer to the People versus OJ. And now, since that has aired and since it was so popular, there's been some ripple effect. And there are other shows in the works that are going to explore avenues of this investigation that have not yet been explored. So I'm really hopeful. And I think you are too, right?
I am. You know, I think it absolutely needs to be explored at the very least. I mean, there are a couple of points that I have to say. There was a documentary that I think the BBC put together, and it involved Bill Deere. And there are a couple of things that I didn't necessarily agree with in terms of what he said, which one was that no parent would ever attack the other parent when the two children were upstairs asleep.
Well, what?
absolutely disagree with that. I've reviewed far too many murders where that exactly...
Where the kids are in the house. In fact, how many, what percentage of them actually witness?
Well, it's over 70%.
Yes.
So that's a study, you know, from years ago.
Yeah, you're outside of your area of expertise. I'm sorry, Mr. Deere. So keep going.
So that part for me, absolutely not. And, you know, not rationalizing in that way and saying, I think there was also something that he had mentioned that OJ was fearful of blood, ergo it could never have been OJ.
Yeah.
You know, there were some really bizarre assumptions and leaps of faith being made. So, you know, I don't agree with everything that was being posited by him. And
he managed, OJ managed to take off a pair of socks that were soaked in blood. He managed to drip blood around his house. He managed to have blood, drop blood in the Bronco. He wasn't that afraid of blood.
But Deere's, his argument is that Jason was the only killer. He doesn't have the...
Of course, that's his theory. Yeah.
But that's not but what it's you guys not, are saying.
No, yeah. not at all. We're yeah. not basing it on yeah. him at all, other than the fact that some of the things that he has pointed out are consistent with what the theory that we've developed independently of him.
Absolutely. And, you know, from reviewing lots of cases, certainly domestic violence murders, child murders, you know, within... you know, the domestic within a domestic setting, you do get an understanding of those crime scene behaviours in a different way. And certainly just the control aspect, as Jim C and I have discussed, you know, it would make far more sense for there to be two people involved, but not necessarily have it planned and orchestrated down to a T. And, you know, that's everything about human behaviour. And there are two people here with motives, certainly one more than the other, which is OJ Simpson. And I don't think it really is in dispute, given what happened with the civil trial and these Bruno Magli shoes and just the fact that he lied and he lied again and he lied again.
So Mr. Deere believes that Jason was wearing his dad's shoes that day or something? Is that what it is? I don't understand. But anyway, that's not really here nor there. I mean, maybe he has viable theories and things to back it up. But the fact is that we don't believe this case is anything other than the extension of a domestic violence, the culmination of a domestic violence series of crimes. And it is something that is absolutely connected to O.J. Simpson, at the very least, maybe his son as well. One of the things about O.J.'s blood and the DNA being at the crime scene, one of the things that Marcia Clark, of course, had said and brought out in the testimony was that the chances of it being O.J. Simpson's blood was, by DNA, 1 in 170 million. And the fact is, like, if you think about that, you know, okay, it's 1 in 170 million, but there's, you know, 7 billion people on the planet or something like that. So there's a lot of people it could have been. But if you think about it as the entire population of the state of California, well, first, the city of Los Angeles, the state of California, the entire West Coast of the United States of America, all the states up to the Mississippi River, probably all the states up to the Eastern Seaboard don't even have 170 million people in them. In other words, I mean, when you get to the eastern side of the country, it's much more populous. You know, there's a lot more people in the cities that go up and down the East Coast than there are up to those states. So the states from the East Coast states westward, I think, probably have about 170 million people in it, something like that. But certainly west of the Mississippi, you're talking about half the population of the United States of America. That it really does rule out, because the vast majority of those people, 20, 30, 40 million, maybe in the entire state of California, right? But when you're talking about 170 million people, most of those people were never in the state of California, were never in the city of Los Angeles, and certainly were not there at the night that Nicole was killed and this blood was deposited at the crime scene. So it really is an amazingly huge number. The odds against it being somebody other than OJ are just minuscule. So when Mr. Deere says that no husband would kill the mother of their children at their home under those circumstances, although we have plenty of anecdotal experience with cases exactly where that did happen in our careers, Laura and I, the fact of this DNA evidence totally outweighs anything that he thinks about whether or not somebody would do that.
Yeah, I mean, Marcia actually said it, and this is where she was good in her sum up, where she said there are only 5 billion people on the planet, So that,
was 20 years ago.
And gentleman is an identification. So it's not in dispute. You know, the forensic evidence puts him there.
But here's my question. I know that the listeners, I can hear them screaming out to
Go
me to
it.
Ask you this, that if that is the case, then where is Jason's blood? Where is the blood evidence with him in that crime scene?
Well, Jason could have been the one that was holding them while OJ was doing the stabbing. The person with the knife is the one that is most likely to get cut because people are fighting. So as I'm coming down, or OJ is coming down with the knife, somebody might hit his arm and he might cut himself somewhere. He's struggling with the knife. He's trying to hold it in place. Sometimes your fingers will go past the hilt. In other words, if you're the one that's actually has the weapon, if somebody is just assisting you by holding the person while you kill them, then that person would be much less likely to get cut, and therefore...
And Nicole
they
has
wouldn't
blood.
Leave blood.
Nicole has blood under her fingernails.
Right. When you mention that, that's the first time I've heard of that.
Well, here's the thing.
Blood group B. So is Jason blood group B? Well, we don't know. But, you know, people always think there's going to be loads of... Of course, there was blood at this crime scene, and there's going to be offender's blood at the crime scene, etc. But as Jim said, it normally is the person wielding the knife. And if Jason is the behind, playing the behind role, then it's, you know, perfectly plausible that he's not leaving... You know, his DNA and his forensics there, albeit there are, you know, there is blood underneath Nicole's nail. So there's still evidence to test there.
Right. And I wonder if the hairs that have been recovered from the watch cap could now produce DNA that we could determine whether or not it's OJ's or his son's. I mean, these are forensics tests that hopefully they still have this material. I don't know, since it's almost since it's an open homicide, I would imagine they should have kept it.
Perhaps Dr. Henry Lee does, but it would certainly be, you know, ripe for retesting, given how much, you know, how many advances have been made. And that's why Jim and I feel absolutely this is a case that should be, you know, further explored and reinvestigated. This is not case closed.
Absolutely. So there it is. That's what I've been waiting for you guys to tell me for... weeks. I remember we were first going to do OJ, Jim. I believe it was you who said you didn't think we had enough material to do more than one podcast.
Yeah, and when people see cases, you know, portrayed, whether it's scripted or unscripted on TV, and it's condensed into an hour.
They expect that.
That's not what happens in real life. And, you know, Jim C. and I, the absolute devil is in the detail of taking things apart, not just accepting what we see in a show, but testing the hypothesis, testing the evidence, testing other people's theories, reading prima facie evidence, not relying on just the things that we hear and see, you know, on a docudrama or, you know, whether it's a scripted one. And so it takes a long time, and preparation for, you know, doing this takes a long time too.
Yes. I mean, we have listened to endless hours of transcripts and depositions, and as well as reading as much material as we possibly can. And we are definitely proposing a theory about who may have also been involved in this double homicide. But there are a tremendous number of indicators that are pointing the way we're talking about. Is it possible that OJ pulled this off on his own? It's possible, but given the forensic evidence at the crime scene, the fact that there's two victims, the fact that that Ron fought back so valiantly, all those are indicators in our mind that there was more than one offender, and the most likely person on the planet would have been Jason Simpson. Thank you very much for listening, and we will... be back soon with another episode of Real Crime Profile. But first, do you have any recommendations for the listeners?
I do. I want to recommend a book called Into the Darkest Corners. Into the Darkest Corner, I should say. And it's by Elizabeth Haynes, who's a friend of mine. And she's a former intelligence analyst who used to work major crime for Kent Police. And she used to be an analyst there and has written, it was her first debut novel actually, Into the Darkest Corner, and it's a fascinating, chilling and terrifying book because it really does detail the nature of insidious under the skin abuse. And I'm not going to say anything more, but it's incredibly well written, so please check it out.
And I'm also going to recommend a book. It's called The Snowman by Yo Nesbo. He has a lead detective, Harry Hool, who's an anti-hero and just a fascinating detective to follow. And it's a great book, The Snowman, if you want to check it out. No, more great Nordic noir to check out.
Yeah, great. I met somebody else who was also recommending Nordic noir, mm-hmm. and they were saying it's how great it is. And mm-hmm. and I was telling them that you have turned us on to a few of those things. So I hope you guys are watching our new show that's on Nat Geo.
Missing Dial.
Missing Dial. Some amazing developments that had just happened. We'll find out more as the days move on. But Sundays at 7 p.m., at least that's the West Coast time, on National Geographic Channel, Missing Dial. You may even see me on there.
Are you playing a dead body again, Jim?
No,
mind star.
No,
I hope not.
All right, guys, thank you so much.
All right. So if you're a fan of the show and you want to help us out, there's a few things you can do. First, subscribe to the show on iTunes, talk to your friends about us, and share the links. And it'd also be great if you could take a survey from our new network, Wondery, at wondery.com/survey.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799-7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.